From the Sky News Centre at 6, a murder inquiry has begun after a passenger was stabbed to death on board a train travelling from Surrey to London. Officers were called to Horsley Station following the attack on the Guildford service to Waterloo. Former Chief Constable of British Transport Police, Andy Trotter, explains the next steps of the investigation.
They'll be putting together a whole line of coverage from the CCTV, and if we can then add to that witness experience of what they saw and who they saw get off and when. So it's a matter of finding out who was on it, eliminating them from the inquiry so we can really start to narrow it down.
South Western Railway says passengers should expect disruption to services between Guildford and Effingham Junction. A man who was freed from prison after murdering a three-year-old girl in the 1970s has been jailed for attempted murder. Stephen Chafer, who's now 57, was on licence when he murdered a woman in Peterborough. A man and woman stabbed in a suspected terror attack in Manchester have thanked transport police for protecting them. The couple were targeted at the city's Victoria station on New Year's Eve. Parents being urged to turn their kids' phones and tablets off an hour before they go to bed, but the Royal College of Paediatrics and Child Health says there's not enough evidence to recommend a limit for screen time. Dr. Tim Smith from Birkbeck University thinks parents should not assume devices are harmful.
The report is quite good in saying that the evidence is too immature. It's too early to say that the screens are actually causing these effects, which is why they hold back on making strong recommendations.
Around 150 lorries are going to be used in rehearsals for possible cross-channel chaos if there's a no-deal Brexit. On Monday, Kent Police will test their plans to alleviate congestion, which could happen if there are extra border checks. And Britney Spears says she's taking an indefinite break from work to care for her father, who has a life-threatening illness. It means the launch of her Britney Domination show in Las Vegas will be put on hold. That's the latest. I'm Amelia Cox.
On BCFM.
It's Friday, 6 o'clock. Welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. Tony Gosling helping me review this week's news. Slip Dem councillor for Brislington West, slated to become Lord Mayor this spring. That's Joss Clark. Former Sunday Times, now IT journalist Kevin Carhill, is here too. Martin Summers is having several weeks off. After the 7 o'clock news, to Israel, some of Likud's coalition partners pull out of the Israeli government. A general election is announced for April. Could this spell the end for Benjamin Netanyahu? A rejection of his racist policies? Will Jewish Israeli voters endorse him in the spring? Or may he use, or others use, black operations to fix the vote? So many votes apparently fixed these days. And the New Year's Eve bombing of a tower block in Magnitogorsk in Russia's remote Chelyabinsk province. Was it an accidental gas explosion, or did the Chechen terrorists kill 40 people? And what about the bus that exploded in the town too? Was that an accident as well? Plus the gunfight at the OK Corral, the Capitol building, versus the White House. Democrat Nancy Pelosi versus Republican Donald Trump. Will she get her government back? And will the American people get their government back, more to the point? And will he get his wall? Or is the whole standoff going to just discredit democracy? About time they moved aside and let the banksters run things, right? And America's standing also is lowered in the world. Bolsonaro takes over in Brazil. He announces a plan to make police and security services immune to prosecution and to set up US bases in the country. Undoing Lula and Rousseff's reforms, both of whom really were ousted by corrupt judges. They are arguably the ones who should be behind bars, not the previous presidents being prosecuted. Plusk, who got Iran interested in acquiring nuclear weapons? Well, Yuval Aviv is a former Mossad officer who was sent to Iran under the Shah, where he worked on the Iranian arm of Israel's nuclear weapons program. That hardly anyone's heard about. That's all in the second hour after seven. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's chilly two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of minus one and dry. This weekend, highs around 9 Celsius, colder with light cloud tomorrow, feeling warmer though with thicker cloud on Sunday. Next week, highs around 9, mainly cloudy with sunny spells. Next weekend, that's the 12th and 13th of January, again around 9 Celsius with sunshine and some fleeting showers. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So helping us review this week's news is Lib Dem Councillor for Brislington West, and she'll be becoming Lord Mayor, it looks like, in May. Joss Clark. Hi, Joss. Welcome to the Politics Show.
Good evening.
So how do you get selected to be a Lord Mayor? How does that all work?
It's on a rotational basis. So
no brown envelopes, anything like that?
No brown envelopes, not in Bristol. So it's on a rotational basis. So the first year it'd be the largest group, which in this instance, Labour, then the Tories, then the Greens, then us. And so it just rotates that way.
And how come you're chosen and not one of the other Lib Dems?
Well, we have an internal election and I was selected.
Have you been given any training? What do you think the post is going to entail? I suppose you've been able to see others doing it in the past few years, haven't you? And you get a fair idea of what it's all about because you're basically the chair, aren't you?
Yeah, I'll be chairing the full council meetings, which is obviously a very public activity. And then quite a lot of the time you'll be doing activities in and around Bristol. So attending meetings, opening events, visiting schools. And I will have a bit of a say in the kind of priorities that I may have.
So one of the other things as being Lord Mayor is that you're supposed to be apolitical, aren't you? Is that going to be easy for you?
It's something that I've had to think about. And what I'm going to do is obviously at full council, I would present petitions and make statements and ask questions to the executive members. And obviously I won't be able to do that. So other people will have to do that for me.
Without giving too much away, is there anything about the way that full council meetings are conducted, particularly the way questions are able to be raised and things like that from the public, that you would like to do what you can to change? I mean, there may be actually limited scope because you're being pretty much told what to do by the legal services people, I imagine. But are there any things about that, the way that part of our democracy in the city works, that you think should be tweaked?
I think there's an observation I'd make. I was a councillor prior to having a mayor, an elected mayor, and it was quite a robust environment, let's say. There was lots of shouting and it did get quite emotional with the councillors. Having an elected mayor has made it a much more sedate affair. But nevertheless, the general public, when the public come to make statements or ask questions, they feel quite often quite emotional about a subject or in a subject area, and you have maybe a lot of people turning up, and that is the part of the meeting which can be quite difficult to control and conduct in an orderly fashion. And I do understand that members of the public, you know, to come to full council to make a statement means you actually care quite passionately about something, and that can be quite difficult
to give up your time for free.
Yes, indeed. The way we have had some less than nice situations with the public in the chamber, security has been strengthened, and I think that has made it better for members of the public generally. We had a flare let off in the council chamber recently, and we've had a couple of other incidents where people have let off things and they've been dragged out, and it's not good for anybody. It's not good for the public, and it's just not good.
What about the argument of robust versus sedate? because, ooh, you know, that sometimes a little bit of argy-bargy is necessary in order to get value for money for whatever it is, 350 million quid of our money you spend every year.
Speaking on a very personal level, actually, I quite enjoyed it when it was quite robust. There was quite a lot of energy in the chamber on occasions, and things were, things were kind of more passionate, let's say.
Because sedate almost makes out that things have already been, or everything's been sort of smoothed over before. It's almost like maybe this, people have had meetings before the meeting, and everything that could go wrong has already been kind of covered and catered for, and everything is just a little bit less democratic, really. And people
I think it's not about that, in my opinion, for what it's worth. I would say that it's around the having a directly elected mayor.
What difference does that make?
It's kind of disempowered a lot of the councillors, because if you look at the example of the arena debate, I mean, I put in questions and statements every single full council about the arena, saying that residents in Brislington West essentially wanted the arena down at Temple Meads because it would be a local facility, and I knew that the decision making process sits with one person, the mayor.
So what difference does that make then? Why does that make it less robust? I mean, surely you can stand up there and say your thing, whoever's in power at the time.
Of course you can stand up and say it, but we had 70 councillors essentially standing up and saying we would like the arena down at Temple Meads. And the mayor said, yeah, I've heard everything you've said, yeah, but it's going to be up in South Gloucestershire, or on the border of South Gloucestershire.
If it happens.
If it ever happens, indeed, yeah.
So
yeah.
What's the fallout been, do you think, from deciding not to do the arena? Because there were a lot of reasons why that Marvin Rees, the mayor, gave, the Labour mayor, saying essentially that it was too risky, that there's lots of public money hanging on it, and then it wouldn't be fair to expose us, the public, you, the councillors, to all that risk if it didn't give the return that was promised.
Well, we did have another company come over from America to talk to the council about, and they actually specialise in inner city arena spaces, but that was rejected. I just think it would be really nice. I think it would add so much to the city, having an arena in the centre of the city. The transport links are good, public transport links, I mean. The benefits to our hotels in the city centre, to shopping, which, you know, and restaurants would be, you know, the money would stay in the city. We wouldn't be giving the money to Cribbs Causeway.
One of the biggest issues in the city almost always, because we are known to be one of the worst cities for our commuting, although tonight it's, you know, not too many cars on the road, but once it comes to next week, it's going to be back to normal again. Are there any thoughts that you've got about transport? Because we seem to have had, I mean, for example, around the Temple Meads area, the roadworks, they're going on and on and on and on. I remember beginning of the year, I went away to New Zealand for a month and came back and thought, well, maybe things will be sorted out by the time I get back. And of course, they just go on and on, and I look at it and I think, what a god awful mess. Why isn't anyone actually this quite often you could drive through, there's no one's actually doing anything, there's no people actually doing the roads. It seems like a permanent roadworks zone.
Well, the transport, public transport in the city is poor. It's unreliable.
That's very kind of you.
I'm on the radio. That's why I'm being quite diplomatic and tactful. But, you know, public transport is not good. Cycling, I cycle in the city. Cycling is not easy, and it is not for the faint-hearted. We need more cycle routes. We need better transport in terms of public transport links. The metro bus in Brislington is not something that really is going to affect me. They've spent a huge amount of money on you know, a couple of buses, and we've got to address it, because driving in the city is becoming intolerable, I think.
And for those that want to use the train, we've just had this big train fare hike. people mostly, it has to be said, up in the north of England, although there's quite a lot of people who commute around London have had a very bad service from the trains. Well, it seems that the opposite of what should be happening is happening. So as the train companies do a really bad job in getting us to and from work or wherever we want to go, seeing our relatives, so they get the slap on the back from the government and get told, oh, you can put the train fares up an inflation or above inflation amount. Now, this is really galling, and it starts to look like a bit of a racket, actually, where people can charge almost what they want for the train fares, and even when they're not even delivering services. They're cancelling services, they haven't employed enough drivers, that sort of thing.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, in terms of the buses, we've got a situation in my part of the city where the 36 bus, which was a notoriously poor, unreliable route and very, very circuitous across the city, they've decided to split it into two, which is, there is some positives in that, but they didn't want to link the two routes. So if you got off at one, you know, the halfway through the route, you'd have to walk across Brislington to get on the other bus to go across the city. And until, you know, we obviously jumped up and down and said this is completely unacceptable. Why don't you actually have the terminus at the park and ride, which is a logical place? But the bus company did not want to go down the A4. And the reason they didn't want to go down the A4 was because it's such a bad road and it actually messes up the timetables.
But they've got bus lanes, for goodness sake, on the A4. Quite a lot of bus lanes, haven't they?
Yep, you're right.
So they're being a bit curmudgeonly, I would suggest to you. If they've already got bus lanes, okay, so it's going to be slower than without bus lanes. But so what is the point of having a bus lane if there's not buses to use it?
Well, yeah, I mean, that bus, they just didn't want to do it. They are doing it now. They are terminating both routes at the same points, which is going to make it a bit easier onward journey. But it just indicates that actually the bus services, even in moving forward, they're not really thinking about their customer.
Is it time to renationalise the buses? Or actually, what they're talking about here in Bristol is having franchising like they have in London, where the bus companies actually get told, you can bid for this route, but where you can't just change the routes willy-nilly. You have to do what you're told.
Yep, I agree with that entirely. I mean, you know, the bus fares are too high. The bus services are really poor. You know, I'm coming into Bristol, coming into the centre of Bristol. I need to know that I can get on a bus, it's going to go where I want to go, and it's going to be reliable and safe.
How would franchising affect that?
Well, I mean, we need a bus service that's going to be effective, and we're going to need enough buses to provide the routes that people want. These metro bus routes are great, but it's just one simple route. It's not actually covering the whole city, is it?
No, all the poorest parts of the city didn't get their metro buses they were promised. Funny that.
Strange.
I think maybe we should just bring in Kevin Carhill. Kevin, I mean, you've seen the whole history of this, the way this has gone over the years, the privatisation of the railways, the privatisation of the buses. Actually, it was the buses first, wasn't it? That was one of the things that Thatcher did, and then the railways under John Major. What do you make of this situation, particularly this hike in rail fares, even though the service has been absolutely appalling, failing Grayling, the Transport Minister? Maybe we can talk about his drone fiasco at Gatwick Airport afterwards, but he doesn't really seem to be serious about making sure that people can get to and from work.
I mean, the passengers get hammered. The service is now worse than it was when British Rail was privatised. But the money goes out to the shareholders and the companies. There is a rip-off going on, a straight rip-off, and nobody polices it. Parliament doesn't hold the companies to account. The government doesn't. The government just takes money from us, gives it to the railway companies, and they give it to their shareholders, and the passengers just get fares dumped on them.
Yeah, and I've seen that they're investing less and less. If you have a look at the graph of what the train companies are actually investing in the networks, it's less and less and less all the time. Difficult to know what to do about all that, but Tim Bowles is the man. He's the man who's supposed to sort the buses out, but he won't come in. And in fact, I've sent him lots of emails, and we were just in the middle of sorting out a date, and then suddenly his secretary went all cold on me, and she won't reply to the emails anymore or the phone calls. So it would be interesting to get him in and explain, Metro Mayor, what are you, first of all, number one, and number two, can we please have some franchising on our buses, and why don't you seem to like it? So there was a question we've got to ask him, I suppose. Also, over the break, Joss, we had the death of the former leader of the Lib Dems, Paddy Ashdown. So I don't know, you know, if you what contact you had with him at all, but he seemed to be, almost a sort of older generation from a different time in politics, where people were maybe. I mean, I don't want to be too gushing about the guy, but he just seemed to be a bit more straight talking than people like Clegg and the more modern Lib Dem generation.
I think he was a really decent chap. I met him a couple of times. Really straight. He was quite a dynamic gentleman. He obviously had a very interesting past, and he'd obviously done a number of things. When he left government, he obviously did some fantastic things as well. And I think he had a great. He was a generally a decent bloke.
Tony, you know, I worked for him for 4 years. Yes, I did. He'd just been elected an MP, and I was a journalist. I was writing stories about IT. It was called computing in those days. And Paddy took up one of the stories, which was the United States fiddling the books and making it impossible for us to build IT or sell it. They had market restrictions everywhere. You couldn't export. Because there was bits of American stuff in every computer built here, they imposed American restrictions in the United Kingdom, and we lost our computer industry completely. And Paddy railed against it. And it's if he had known what his future was, I wonder would he have done it? Because if you rile the Americans here, your political career here comes to a halt.
I mean,
it sounds
a bit similar to what's been going on with this Huawei executive over in Canada, where the Americans are saying, well, you've been dealing with the Iranians and we don't want you to deal with the Iranians, therefore we're going to arrest you. So the idea is the Americans have got this attitude that everyone has to do as they say.
Well, we'll come to that in another. But Paddy, certainly, he was relentless. He took risks that I wouldn't have recommended to him, funnily enough. Both of us were Irish and both of us were ex-military, so it made a very easy link. I liked him a lot. He was very easy to work. Once he got to know you, then you could pretty well do what you want.
He's a bit of a local lad as well. He was living down in near Yeovil, at Norton Subhampton. Stoke Subhampton. No, Norton Subhampton, that's right.
Norton Subhampton,
I remember I got chatting with his son a few times down there. But anyway, also, another thing about Paddy is that he says, and I don't know what you make of this, Joss, that David Miliband killed off the Lib Lab coalition. Now, this is in 2010 when there was a bit of where the Lib Dem coalition with the Conservatives. This is what he wrote in the Telegraph at the time. He said that actually the Lib Dems and people like him in the Lib Dems wanted to have a coalition with Labour, but it was killed off by David Miliband. Do you remember him? He was the Foreign Secretary under Gordon Brown. Apparently, Lord Ashdown, this is back from June 2010 in the Telegraph, Lord Ashdown, the former Lib Dem leader, disclosed for the first time that he contacted Tony Blair with an urgent message for Mr. Miliband at the height of the negotiations, but Miliband refused to pass the messages on and refused to speak. So it just sounds as if, he was a bit of a whistleblower too, and he probably would have rather had a coalition with the Labour Party than Ed Miliband than he would have done with the Tories, Joss.
Well, we all know how it all finishes. I don't know whether, I mean, history, I don't know. I can't really comment on that.
Paddy was interesting. Emotionally, Paddy was Labour. He was a Lib Dem, a Liberal, because intellectually he couldn't accept the rigidities of Labour. But he was shafted actually by Nick Clegg when it came to the actual coalition. Paddy was negotiating with Labour, and the person who was negotiating behind his back with David Cameron was Nick Clegg.
Do you think the Lib Dems are ever going to recover from Nick Clegg and the sort of vision of him with David Cameron? Because it does seem that the Lib Dems have had electoral disasters ever since. There were people saying at the time, you know, look, you know, we've got to get rid of Clegg because he's actually doing us a disservice. And a lot of people simply won't vote Lib Dem anymore, many people say, because of that alliance back in 2010, from 2010 to 2015.
Yeah, I think you have a point there. That photograph in the Rose Garden, I think, will probably haunt us for a number of years to come. I think that the Lib Dems have always done well locally, and we are pulling ourselves back up locally, and I think that's where our strength lies, to be honest with you.
I mean, I shouldn't be saying this, but the Rose Garden was two posh upper-class twits twitting each other. Only one was slightly smarter than the other, i.e. Cameron. And the clown, the fall guy, was Nick Clegg.
Before we get totally off, we were talking about the railways just now. One fascinating little story came out on the 26th of December in the I paper, and there's various other people reporting similar things. Railway lines axed by beaching decades ago could be reopened under Department of Transport plans. Department for Transport's working with groups to explore reopening lines closed in the 1960s. Old train lines axed decades ago under notorious reforms designed to make Britain's railways more cost-effective, ha-ha, that didn't work, did it? Thinking at work about reopening a number of railway lines closed with Dr. Beeching. Chris Grayling, well, let's hope his hands aren't touching this project too much. The Transport Secretary announced a year ago that that proposals should be submitted to his department, and now they're looking through them. Do you think there's any mileage in this? I mean, we're talking about HS2, maybe you first, Kevin. They're talking about HS2, the price of which is now slated at £111 billion. And yet here's another possible way we could be spending money, by reopening railways.
No, well, Grayling is... You need to catch up with the other controversy that Channel 4 did last night. This company that's going to run... Okay, it is another way around it. And again, Parliament is not being effective over, you know, insisting that the cost escalation stops. But then you'd have to go back and say, why did they start it in the first place? Why weren't contracts and costs properly estimated then? So again, it's, you know, Parliament failing again.
We had, didn't we? I think it was Dawlish. The railway line fell into the sea a few years ago.
That affects us, you know, because I used that line, and yeah, it survived for about 90 years, and it got washed into the. And the fix was supposed to be forever. It's gone again. It's lasted 2-3 years. I mean, why can't we build things properly?
Well, that's a good question. Anyway, what do you make of the idea of reopening railway lines? I suppose we've got the obvious ones around here. Portishead, that's the obvious one.
I think it's a lovely notion. I think the reality would be very, very difficult, thinking about railway lines. I know that he just used... Farmers have taken them into their parts of their fields. It's not just a question of reopening the railway lines. In Brislington, we have an old railway line. The bridge bit that went over the road is gone. I mean, the infrastructure costs to actually re-establish these railways would be phenomenal. And a lot of them in private ownership, the bits of land as well.
Would it be more than HS2?
Ah, well, there you go.
Maybe not. I honestly don't think HS2 is going to happen, honestly, because it's just getting to it's a bit like the Hinkley Sea. It seems to me people have signed contracts and things, but then everyone's saying, well, okay, well, where are we going to get the money from? All very well to sign the contract, but you've got to come up with a dosh if you want to do it. So you mentioned just now, Kevin, the new Brexit ferry firm being ridiculed. Well, you were hinting at it anyway.
Seashell.
Over copy and paste website. Questions are being asked about the readiness of Seaborne Freight to handle £13.8 million contract. First, it emerged that the start-up company hired to operate extra ferries as part of the no-deal Brexit planning had no ships. Now, questions are being asked about the readiness of Seaborne Freight to handle the contract after it turned out the terms and conditions on its website had been intended for a food delivery firm.
I looked at the company today in Company's House. They have no money either. So they have no harbour, they have no ships, they have a contract system that's from a pizzeria, and they have no money.
Apparently,
there's no money in the company.
They don't have terms and conditions from pizzeria anymore because last night it disappeared off the website. This is no deal planning, Jess. Anyway, do you want to just say what you make of the whole March the 29th scenario? What do you think is going to happen?
I have absolutely no idea. I don't think anybody can second guess it. I just think the whole thing has been an absolute nightmare. I can't even guess at it these days. There's so many twists and turns to come.
I mean, isn't it simple, really, that Theresa May is just trying to delay and delay and delay? Then there's a vote. Then her deal gets thrown out. And then there's a no-deal Brexit is what we get. I mean, it's possible, of course, that there may be no Brexit at that point.
Well, I don't know.
I think the if you like, I'm an immigrant here. I'm from Ireland, so I get a slightly different perspective. I don't agree with it. You can't work out. You can easily work out what's going to happen in certain areas. The ports are going to be a catastrophe. The airports are going to be a catastrophe. This is predictable. You know, it's not guesswork. It's not, oh, gosh, we don't know. We do. Farming, I've never seen anything as thick as the president of the National Farmers Union. She's standing there waffling. The farmers are going to lose their subsidy. Yeah. The import duty on lamb and everything to the continent, where 60% of all our exports go, is going to be 40%. We're not going to be able to sell anymore on the continent.
I just want to point out with the ports, the guy that runs the UK ports, he says actually all the contingency planning has been done and the delays will not be through customs and things like that, because what they're going to do is they're going to allow almost all the traffic to go through. They're just going to use intelligence to pick out one or two vehicles to check on. And also that when you're booking particularly freight onto the ships, that you've got to submit all of the customs documents before you get a ticket. So that's all done electronically. So he's saying he gets really annoyed every time people say what you've just said and wants to throw something at the radio or the TV.
No, I sat beside the chairwoman of the United Kingdom's Export Institute. I went on a thing in Dublin, and she has actually costed it. The on cost, the additional cost of filling in forms is going to be between 17 and 20 billion. At the moment, we don't have forms to fill in. Anybody in the UK exporting, or for that matter importing, has fairly minimal paperwork. And she has done the figures. And yes, that's another thing that can be absolutely predicted. If we leave the Union, it'll cost us between 17 and 20 billion in additional staff to fill in forms.
Well, the guy's name is Tim Morris. He's chief executive of UK Major Ports Group, and he said the UK port sector is resilient, adaptable, highly competitive, offering customers a range of options. We'll work through the challenges of Brexit, he says, and also that almost all of the paperwork is already being done. It won't be extra paperwork, and that they're preparing to allow almost all the vehicles to go backwards and forwards without checks.
Okay, no. He said all these things, and it's true that you should repeat them. But look, when it came to the transport thing, they spent 13 million hiring a company that has no ships, no contracts, and no money.
More to the point, why are they hiring a company to provide ships when the problem looks like it's more likely to be at the ports?
Yeah.
You know, not ships to take people over, but delays through the ports. Doesn't sound like they're very well organised, just, does it?
No, they're not at all.
But Tony, the Grayling has rented something like 200, 500 acres of Kent. to stack up the lorries. That's not a solution. That's a catastrophe. A solution would be to get a system that got the lorries moving and kept them moving. He's planning for stacking trucks on top of each other all over Kent.
So you think there'll be a no deal? You think that's almost certain, do you?
I have, you know, been here for 50 years, and I, funnily enough, I have a lot of faith in the UK electorate. The UK electorate, if it knows what's happening, will not vote to hurt itself. And any politician, including Theresa May, who doesn't understand that, doesn't understand this country. The one thing ordinary voters won't vote for is to injure themselves. They voted for Brexit because they were lied to.
Do you think there will be a second referendum?
Well, I can't. It's beginning to look as if there's no other solution.
Joss?
Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, they're saying is 50-50 now, aren't they, for a second referendum, which. As a Lib Dem, obviously, I would like a second referendum, but I see it as being a very complicated and quite a problematic.
Isn't that going to just extend the pain? Most people just want this all over with, don't they?
They do want it all over with, but the thing is, if you have a second referendum, nobody's going to be satisfied. I think that you're going to have the bar, it's going to have to be a decent majority, so 60%.
I mean, the last referendum wasn't even organised properly. No. But if the Electoral Commission supervised the next one and people weren't allowed to bring in foreign money and they weren't allowed to lie, if the Electoral Commission had policed it and stopped, you know, people saying you'll be 250 million a quick.
Apparently more money was spent on the Remain campaign, and the government also had an air official campaign was a Remain campaign. So some people, Brexit people, would say that's not fair either.
Well,
I mean, surely you've just got to do what has been voted for and then see what happens. You might have another referendum if it all goes wrong.
One of the things that slightly concern me is what questions do you ask people? If you have another referendum, what would be the questions on the ballot paper?
It would be fairly easy, actually, if the election was policed, to make sure that people didn't bring in. A number of people who put money legitimately into Brexit, you know, who paid the Leave people, have made hundreds of millions. It was predictable in financial terms that if even just the referendum would wobble the pound.
Well, we've got a bit of a problem. We've got a problem here, haven't we, in that people can now gamble on a financial disaster. So if this looks like it might turn into a financial disaster, there'll be a few very rich people wringing their hands saying, great, we're going to bet on a disaster here.
No, they have. No, it's already known. People like Chris Odie. Odie has made about 120 million betting against the pound. Because it was predictable. It was predictable that...
Anyway, we had another referendum on this. We've already had a referendum on it back in 1973 where we decided we were going to stay in the EEC. And I've heard very, very little from the original common market stuff from whatever it was. Is it 35 years ago? 45
years ago. Yeah, it was a long time ago.
And when we joined. And here is a clip from a discussion between Michael Foot, who was the Labour leader at the time, and Edward Heath.
Here at Westminster, if you set up a new parliament in Strasbourg, which is going to be the governing authority for the whole of Western Europe, now I think Mr. Heath wants that because he wants an economic and monetary union for the whole of Western Europe. He wants, in effect, a federal solution to the whole of the matter. The only way you can make that democratic is to set up a federal parliament. That's the logical development of that, but don't let anybody who's in favour of that development, which I think is the logical development, deny that what they're proposing is the destruction, the dismemberment of the British Parliament.
I imagine you will deny that, won't you, Mr. Heath?
Well, what Michael Foot has been saying is a grotesque distortion of what the position is. And if his fellow socialists in the Federal Republic of Germany and the other member countries of the community were to hear him talking like this, they would laugh their heads off. to be accusing the SPD in Germany of being an undemocratic party and being so, an undemocratic government by being a member of the community and operating the institutions. This is just fantasy. Now, let me deal with...
referee a little bit. I'm not quite sure that he said that, and I'm sure you... I mean, it seems to be that he is saying that they are members of an undemocratic organisation.
Well, let me deal with this, but he's implying that they have accepted an undemocratic organisation.
Yes. Yes.
And they set out to create it, and they would just laugh at such fantasies. They think it's sheer nonsense. Do you think Brandt believes that for a moment? Now, I'm going to deal with all of these points one by one. You've had a very long say. Now, first of all, this argument that we're not really in the community. This is completely fallacious. When I signed the accession treaty in Brussels, on behalf of the British people, fully authorised by the British Parliament, we became a full member of the community. The fact that in particular spheres, like agriculture, we have a transitional arrangement doesn't in any way alter the fact that we are a full member of the community.
Now, I might be a bit of a quirky person, but I quite enjoy hearing these discussions from all that time ago, where actually, Joss, the tables were turned because it was the Conservatives that were trying to push us into the EC. And mostly people like Michael Foot, we've heard there, and Peter Shaw were doing their best to keep us out. And they were some of the main protagonists in the debate at the time.
Yeah, interesting. I mean, the language, I think, does speak of the time, doesn't it? Yes. I think we have moved as a society quite a long way in that period of time.
I can actually remember the debates and everything in it, yeah. But one of the problems is that Jeremy Corbyn has taken up Michael Foot's position. You know, the EU is a capitalist plot and bad for workers. And actually, it's turned out to be reasonable for workers, not brilliant.
Isn't it employment law here in the UK is probably worse, isn't it, than in most parts of the European Union?
Sorry, I didn't quite catch it. Our employment rate is
our better. Employment law here doesn't give people the same sort of protections. I mean, we've got loads of people now on 0 hours contracts, for example. But anyway, look, we got no Prime Minister's questions this week, but I thought what we'd do is just take some that we didn't use from before Christmas and look at some of the things to do with health injustice. And this was in Prime Minister's questions just before Christmas, so let's have a listen to that now.
Graham Morris.
Thank you. Yeah. It's only a few short months since the Prime Minister promised us an end to austerity. So why, at a time when demands on council resources in deprived areas like mine are increasing and indeed health inequalities are widening, does the Prime Minister believe that it's right to cut the public health budget for County Durham by £19 million and increase the public health budget in affluent Surrey by £14 million?
Yeah. Can I say to the Honourable Gentleman that obviously there are funding arrangements that apply across in terms of the decisions in relation to these sums of money. But he talks about disparities that occur. Of course, funding per dwelling for the local authority in Durham is more than it is in other areas. Like, it's more than it is in my Maidenhead constituency. So there are proper ways of looking at these issues. There are proper ways of looking at these issues and ensuring, as we are, by putting more money into our local authorities, that the money is there for local authorities to do the job that they need to do.
Well, it's nice to hear the Prime Minister saying she's putting more money into local authorities there. I don't know if you've been experiencing this, Joss, have you?
No, definitely not. Budgets are being squeezed all over the place, and it is more difficult to get things done as a local councillor and as part of my role working for an organisation called We Care and Repair, which gets local authority funding.
So what's the latest with the organisation? Tell us a little bit about what you do and what you've been up to.
We Care and Repair, an organisation I've been working for 11 years. We get our core funding from the local authorities of Bristol and Baines, and we work to help people stay in their homes for longer. So we do quite a lot of adaptations to people's properties, so as their health needs change, so level access showers, things like that. I do a lot of hospital discharge work, so getting people out of hospital, because obviously the pressures are to use the beds effectively, and there are a lot of pressures on resources like obviously people going into residential situations, people wanting to stay in their own homes for longer.
So look, I mean, the problem here, just to try and sort of crystallise it a little bit, is that you've got people who have been through a hospital for whatever reason, and then it's just simply not safe to say to them, right, you can go home now. So you need to have some either adaptations at home or a care plan put in place so that people are visiting them at home, nurses or whoever, in order to look after them.
What I find in the hospitals is that people come into hospital, they've been quite poorly before they came in, their housing situation may have been deteriorating over quite a long period of time, and it's not safe for them to return. So the hospital is looking at a situation where they either adapt or clean the house so that they can go home, or the person ends up in residential care, which is £1,000 a week. So the service that I provide is we go into hospitals, meet the client and the occupational therapist, and I do whatever I need to do to a property to make it safe so somebody can go home.
It's a bit worrying to think that these properties are dirty, need cleaning. I mean, you know, people in the situation in their homes where they maybe they're not actually in a physically good enough state to keep the place tidy and clean.
One of the things I found really interesting is that years ago I used to work as a councillor with the housing department, and the housing officers would go and lean on Mrs. Jones's door frame and say, get your front garden cleared up, and they would see what's going on in the house because they were collecting the rent and they were on the patch and they knew people. And those officers unfortunately don't exist now. They're not on the patch, and so the houses or a house can maybe deteriorate, the person's situation can change, and there's nobody keeping an eye on them in the way that they used to. I mean, that's obviously council house stock.
Well, I tell you what, maybe we should be keeping an eye on each other a little bit more and talking to councillors. You know, I'm not saying that the council shouldn't be doing it, but I mean, I would have thought that, you know, a call to you or to another councillor saying, look, this person is in council property of some sort and they're really not necessarily... I mean, could you do anything for somebody like that?
Well, what I can do is if there is a serious issue, I can obviously raise a safeguarding request, and I can put in, using the skills that I have through my work, I can obviously support people and point them in the right direction. Quite often that would be the voluntary sector these days, and charities, to maybe offering a befriending, a lunch service, something like that, just to keep them engaged and keep maybe a shopping, because people come in and do a shopping service, so they're coming into the house and they will see what's going on.
It's a pretty awful situation, isn't it, where people are sort of getting ill, living on their own and isolated, and there's nobody necessarily looking out for them anymore. I mean, you do some work at RUH in Bath, don't you? Can you just explain that? Is that what you've been talking about here?
Yeah, well, I mean, I happen to work in Baines, so I cover all the four hospitals in Baines, so I do the discharge work for people, and quite often I'll get a call from the ambulance service. They've been into a property and they may not have brought the person into hospital, but they can see that things are deteriorating, and we can help and support them get their house back on track. And I also do a lot of work, I'll do end of life work with people where they need changes made to the property so that they can go home, and also as people's needs change, if they've, you know, they need to maybe live downstairs for a period of time, we can do all of that sort of thing.
But I mean, there's less and less money, apparently, less and less money for elderly care nowadays, and it's becoming a bit difficult to even to get what is rightfully yours.
Well, there is, but it's really cost effective. A service like this is really cost effective in terms of keeping somebody in hospital £500 a day, or a modest amount of money, I can get somebody out of hospital. Can I just mention at this stage that We Care and Repair, which has been around for 30 years, is actually, we're changing our name. So we're going to become We Care Home Improvements. I had to close my eyes to think about that because it's not going to trip off the tongue for a little while. And that actually is a reflection of the position that we're in. We used to get our core funding, which covered a lot of our services, from the local authorities. That money is diminishing, and we're having to look more and more to fee-paying clients to actually deliver our services.
So what have you've had council cuts then? What sort of percentage?
Year on year, we've had cuts, definitely. Yeah, I mean, we're talking, it's sort of salami slicing year on year. But it's not only the amount of money, it's what they want for the money as well. So we have been squeezed, and we are having to now seriously look at services we deliver and looking at people paying for their own.
I mean, this is very easy to look at this and what's going on. We're doing that. Thank you ever so much for explaining some of this for us. Just for a lot of people, this is, you know, this is something which is out of sight, out of mind. We don't often see what's going on behind someone's care package or whatever. But the ultimate thing behind all this, surely, is just the lack of money that the government's got to spend on this sort of thing, which surely comes back to 2008, Kevin, doesn't it? You know, to the financial crisis, the bailout, the banks that should have gone bust but didn't, and instead we gave them something like £850 billion to bail them out. And now the government is saying, well, I'm sorry, we're running out of money.
Yeah, it does go. I mean, the United Kingdom is very unusual. We didn't prosecute anybody. A very specific number of people with names and addresses wrecked the economy, and not one of them has been prosecuted. Fred Thingy from the Bank of Scotland, the Royal Bank of Scotland, lost his knighthood. Big deal. Iceland put most of the people who bust their banks in jail. Ireland's put a few. America's put some. But the United Kingdom is unique. Nobody paid. And now the people Jazz is trying to take care of are suffering because of it.
Well, there you go. It's the banksters, folks, and they want to take over. They want us government democratic types out of the way because they think they can run things better than us. God, I have to pick a bone with them over that one. But anyway, let's have a listen now, because this refers to Lloyds here in Bristol. And this was also a question which was brought up at Prime Minister's Questions just before Christmas.
Kevin Hollenrake.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Senior managers at Lloyds and HBOS were convicted of a disgraceful fraud against their own business customers. Now there is compelling evidence of a cover-up at the highest level, including a recent admission of the disgraceful mistreatment of a whistleblower. And this week, the compensation scheme for victims was described by the QC, Jonathan Laidlaw, as partial to the bank's interests. Does my right honourable friend agree that the Chief Executive, Antonio Horta Osorio, should now consider his position, and also that the compensation scheme should be replaced by an independent process of arbitration?
Can I first of all say to my honourable friend that this is an important issue he's raised, and I know he has consistently campaigned on this, and he's, I understand, raised this yesterday in a debate in Westminster Hall. The events, as he has said in his question, the events at HBOS Reading, at that branch, constituted criminal activity, and it's right that those responsible were brought to justice. Now, decisions about whether to launch a financial services conduct investigations are the responsibility of the Financial Conduct Authority as the independent regulator for the sector, and I understand they're currently conducting two investigations into the events at HBOS Reading, including the bank's communications with regulators following the discovery of the misconduct. Obviously, we look forward to the conclusions of these investigations, and I know my honourable friend will continue to champion the needs and the concerns of all those who found themselves recipients and victims of what was identified as criminal activity.
Well, this whistleblower was reported back in November last year. Lloyds Banking Group apologised for the distress and inconvenience caused to former executive Sally Masterson after the so-called Project Turnbull report was published earlier this year and named her as the author. The explosive dossier claimed former Lloyds and HBOS bosses knew about a major fraud at HBOS's Reading branch before it was taken over by Lloyds. A scam led to six people being jailed for a combined 47 years last February. But I'm also referring to Lloyds here in Bristol, who I've heard through various sources used a special project at Lloyds. And when people are getting into problems with their debt, maybe they want to change interest rates or change the people who are financing the debt, what they do is they set them all sorts of impossible tasks to perform, and they end up losing their home, they can end up losing their business, and this is just seen as a way for Lloyds to acquire more and more property, more and more wealth, people's wealth.
You know, that's what they did in Reading. That's the pattern is the same. The businesses were pushed into debt, and the people who pushed them into debt then took over the businesses. Some of them are Lloyd's managers, and six of them are in jail. But it's interesting that there were 8 years of stalling by the police, by Lloyd's, and by the financial regulator. And the only reason the case was pushed into court was Tony Stansfeld, the local police commissioner. He took almost a revolutionary stand. And the interesting thing is Tony is a former brigadier, not the kind who do revolution. But it took his pressure to get those people before the courts. But there are other instances in what you talk about. There were a lot of other instances like that, in not just RBS, but there were Lloyd's, Barclays have a problem, NatWest had a problem. It was a common pattern, and only one of the cases has gone to court.
So is it still going on, this, do you think?
It's faded off, because now the fact that six people went to jail has made people careful. But there are historic cases, and there were at least 10 on the scale of Reading around the country.
I mean, this works in the interests of big business, doesn't it? The big chains, because this is almost all exclusively smaller businesses, maybe employing 10, 20 people, or a handful of people. And so the small business people are being kicked out as a result of this, really.
Squeezed out.
And having their property, whatever, stolen, a viable business, is just totally undermined. Josh, what do you make of this? This is a bit of a sort of sticky situation, particularly when we have... I mean, I've been speaking to people down in Weston-super-Mare who say that that's been going on with Lloyd's here in Bristol, doing exactly the same, where they just see these people as... Basically, they just don't have the legal ability to employ the top-notch barristers to fight them through the courts.
It's really difficult, isn't it? I mean, that's large business, you know, crushing smaller businesses. It's not an area that I know much about, so I can't really comment, but it's an issue for politics. Yeah.
Because there's a second issue hidden in it. The cost of going to law has become... The law has been stolen from ordinary people. No ordinary person can afford to go to law. And there's a huge problem there. I've forgotten how Tony organized, the police commissioner, organized it, but he got enough help for the victims, for them, you know, to be able to push. But yeah, there are at least 10 cases as serious as Reading around the country, and you're saying one of them is in Bristol. But that's not a surprise.
Okay, so I think we're going to just return briefly to Brexit before we get to the end, because it's going to consume us all, I'm afraid, up until the end of March. Italian health czar has resigned and blames anti-science government on this. And this is part of the anti-corporate EU feeling around Europe. The Italian health czar has resigned and blames the anti-science government. This is largely to do with vaccines and things like this. The president of Italy's National Health Research Organization said he had been driven to resign due to anti-scientific policies of the country's new government, including efforts to undermine confidence in vital vaccinations. Professor Walter Riccardi of the National Health Institute said an aversion to evidence-based policy among a coalition of Italy's far-right league and anti-establishment five-star movement put public health at risk. What do you make of this? It's a really difficult medical issue, but do you have concerns about whether these big pharmaceutical industries are providing quality vaccinations or quality medical services as they used to? I know we've got an increasing amount of private players now in the healthcare system, such as people like Richard Branson sort of getting involved, people like that. Do you think that's we're going, is it a privatisation too far with this kind of private businesses lobbying for controlling our healthcare in Britain?
I think there are real issues about private industry coming in. I mean, obviously, we've always had private players in the health industry, but I think there is an effect on the cost and the pricing that is dragging money out of the private, out of the public sector, and that means we have less services. With Brexit, I do worry about research and development in future medicines, etc.
and also possibly the American companies wanting to come into Britain, American private healthcare companies. What do you make of the vaccination?
Do you remember the controversy? There was this doctor who said, you've got, what was it?
Andrew Wakefield, you're talking about, the MMR vaccine guy. Yeah.
He is still supported in America and in Italy and in parts of Germany. There are people who go around saying, no, he was right if you have the...
Well, I think maybe he was. I hate to say it. I mean, you have to listen to what he's got to say. He makes some extremely powerful points. And also, what he's suggesting is that the big pharmaceutical companies are really controlling the regulation of the whole business these days. Anyway, time now for the Murdoch News at 7. Thanks to our guest Lib Dem councillor for Brislington West, Lord Mayor in May, we hope, Joss Clark. Join us after the news.
Station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour. Live from the Sky News Centre.